From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Sometimes we're overlooked, left behind, or ignored. Unless, of course, we're misunderstood.
It's a very unempowered position to always be saying, oh, this is what we aren't, instead of an opportunity to show who we really are. And that we is a multitude.
Also, a pair of Venezuelan sisters separated by distance and political turmoil.
The government is still engaging in all kinds of human and civil rights violations with the opposition leaders and with all the protesters that have been imprisoned.
Plus, the politics of natural hair and the dual personalities of the bilingual. All this and more coming up as we ask, why not me? On Latino USA, I'm Maria Hinojosa. No se vayan.
Who really cares about tomorrow? Who really cares about today?
Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. You know, as Latinos, we most often don't see ourselves reflected accurately or fairly in the media, besides Latino USA, of course. And that's true for other groups as well. Let me give you some examples. On the front page of the New York Times, men are quoted three times more often than women. More than three quarters of the entire news workforce for TV is white. Almost 80% of all characters from the top films of 2012 were white. And of those white characters, 70% were men. Now, I could go on and on, but the fact is, white men dominate the media in this country. And that can make many people, especially women of color, feel like we don't belong in the media. But that's starting to change. Take, for instance, BuzzFeed. In many ways, it's the future of millennial media. Recently, BuzzFeed launched a slightly more inventive section of their site called Ideas. And as its editor, they chose 23-year-old Aisha Siddiqui. Siddiqui is not Latina, but the issues that matter to her matter to all of us, like confronting racism, sexism, and problems of being seen as the other. We wanted to hear why she so boldly asked, "Why not me?" Aisha Siddiqui joins us in our studio here in Harlem to talk about the changing face of new media. Welcome to Latino USA, Aisha.
Thank you.
So you were born in England. When you were about 3 or 4 years old, you moved to Pakistan, and you're there when you're until you're about six, and then you moved to the United States, right?
Yes.
And I have this image of you in a house with like a courtyard, and you running around, and someone cooking food, and lots of sound and nature. Am I right?
You're absolutely right.
Oh, it sounds delicious. Now, from there, you then moved to Hartford, Connecticut?
That's right.
What was that like?
I mean, we moved around a lot, but it was always to very white, very homogenous suburbs. And those are the formative experiences that shaped the issues I, you know, grew to really care about now as an adult.
I mean, there's a lot around identity, a lot around power shifting, a lot around the media, invisibility. Tell me about that connection. The headstrong young Pakistani girl who then becomes a headstrong young American woman, journalist, editor, influencer.
Well, it was really a process of rediscovering that original headstrong young girl that for most of my time in this country was not allowed to be that way or to really have a space and voice. And it was the openness and availability of Twitter and the internet. And when I joined Twitter, it wasn't in anticipation of any sort of audience. It was just a platform to which no expectations or prestige or anything, you know, or even requirements were attached. You just got on and said what you wanted to say. And that certainly was a very significant moment in rediscovering my voice. Absolutely. And sort of developing a vocabulary to name all of the experiences I'd grown up with, and then discovering how common they are to many young people of color across America.
So what specifics of vocabulary are you talking about? Because you're basically saying there is an invisible language that the mainstream media, overwhelmingly run by white men over 50. Mm-hmm. What's the vocabulary that they're missing that you got and that people who follow you also get?
Well, to begin with, just the basic facts of racism. And, you know, the ability to name something is an opportunity to exercise a level of power over it. And that can be an incredible bomb in retrospect to apply to all of the, you know, aggression or hostility or just general, you know, unwelcomeness that we as, you know, young people in America, people of color may encounter, particularly immigrants, South Asians. And to return to those experiences with, you know, the power to name them for what they were and what they are, and to name whiteness and to name hegemonic powers is definitely the first step towards confronting them and challenging them, really.
You wrote an article about a pilot. It was ABC Family's Alice in Arabia. Your article was called Alice is in Arabia and the rest of us hold our breath. You basically wrote about how the show was going to be offensive. I mean, it was based on a little American girl that gets kidnapped. So already it's just like, you're kidding. This is the, and somehow we're supposed to be excited about what she's going to learn about Arabia, quote unquote. The ABC Family ends up canceling the show. A lot of people were probably very upset about that, but it does say a lot about precisely the power that you're saying you now name.
You know, it wasn't something that I would have imagined to be possible even a year ago, but it was such an incredible story to watch unfold. We got a hold of the script, actually, from our LA office, and Rega Jahu wrote a piece. She was able to, you know, go through and explain all of the problems that we'd anticipated ended up being, in fact, a reality written into the pilot. And so what was interesting about what happened with Alice in Arabia is that our sentiments and reactions were not particularly unique. Had this show been proposed in 1990, 2007, the people who felt the way they did would have felt similarly. I mean, there are very familiar archaic tropes that the show was planning on invoking. What was unique is that our frustration was allowed to be collective because it was allowed to be seen across this platform that made it visible not only to everyone else, but to each other. And so now it was no longer, you know, someone living in a suburb of Arkansas or, you know, an activist in New York. It was everyone seeing in real time at once that our reactions and our frustrations, they manifest in like so many, in such at such high volume. To be able to harness that volume, you have to be aware of it first. And that's what we were. There was the Alice in Arabia hashtag on Twitter that connected so many voices, calling out not only the stereotypes of the show, but what it would mean for the rest of us to have to live with them.
In other words, we already have an identity.
Exactly, yeah.
What would happen if you actually listened to us about our identity, and then we wouldn't have to spend all our time saying, no, that's not who we are?
Absolutely, because to consistently only be in a position to where you're responding to stereotypes, you're legitimizing them in the discourse, and you are accepting that it's a very unempowered position to always be saying, oh, this is what we aren't, instead of an opportunity to show who we really are. And that we is a multitude. And I mean, especially as a Muslim woman, the burden of constantly myth-busting.
And not having a television show.
Absolutely.
Like, if you had your own television show called Mythbusters and you were being paid a nice big salary, that might be fun.
Sure, right. But we don't have that. And it's simply not effective. I mean, we've been trying to shatter stereotypes, which is like the common phrase, like, oh, Muslim women shattering stereotypes, Muslim woman doing X despite being a Muslim woman. That's the narrative, that whatever it is we accomplish as Muslim women, it's in spite of our identities rather than through them or because of them. And so my stance on that is very much, if, you know, myth busting was effective, we would have gotten rid of them a long time ago.
So when you think about the response to the kinds of pieces that you put out, which again have a lot to do with power media, is it mostly love that you're getting back?
It is. It's been incredibly gratifying how well received these, you know, inaugural pieces from BuzzFeed Ideas have been. Just the amount of actual gratitude. People have been emailing me, sending messages and comments about how much they've valued some of the conversations that Ideas has been able to host so far, because they were conversations that they honestly, like me, didn't imagine possible even months ago. We did a roundtable discussion on the Mindy Project, and we're able to talk about experiences and subjects that would have been so valuable to me as a young South Asian girl growing up in America, but it's been just as moving to be able to offer that to others. And, you know, some of the messages on Twitter and on the article from not just South Asian girls, but even, you know, Black men have emailed me about that piece and how much it spoke to them, Asian Americans, everyone. And it's so exciting to be a part of that, a part of determining what is now possible.
It is a known fact that you are a huge fan of Kanye West.
That's right.
And you use Kanye West as a kind of prism with which to look through at a bunch of issues. Why Kanye? And is what attracts you to him the fact that he talks openly about learning to believe in the power of our voice and of our narrative?
Absolutely. Kanye West is such an interesting figure for the absolute rage he inspires in so many others. And regardless of how people feel about his music or his celebrity, it has always been fascinating to me how people feel about his ego and what right he has to talk about himself and his talent the way he does. And so often that, you know, arbitration of how much of his own genius he's allowed to be aware of parallels what many young people, especially people of color in America, face in terms of owning their own talents and voice and feeling entitled to spaces that we're taught we should just barely be grateful to be allowed in. And that is why I find Kanye West to be such an inspiring figure. It's so fascinating to me that someone who has earned so many accolades of that genre, he's won every award, his albums have gone number one, they have been so massively successful. His talent and vision are undeniably historically significant even, yet still he's considered to overvalue himself. And as he said in his now infamous Zane Lowe interview, if you're a fan of Kanye West, you're not a fan of me, you're a fan of yourself. His self-presentation is really a subversive practice of how to value yourself in a society and system that is so intent on determining your value for you.
There are a lot of people who I think don't even recognize or want to see the kind of amazing shift that is happening. As you said, it's happening by the hour, The change in this country. We're a part of that change. Even this conversation is part of that change. Are you optimistic about the future, or do you think that, you know, I mean, there's been hate crimes that have occurred in just recently, so...
I don't think I'd, you know, be able to do my job without a modicum of optimism. So much of what I didn't even dare to be optimistic about is now firmly a part of our reality, and there are trends that are now inevitable. So that is exciting, and... You know, the world is changing whether people are comfortable with it or not.
Thanks so much for joining us in the conversation, Aisha.
Thank you for having me.
Aisha Siddiqui is the editor of BuzzFeed Ideas. You can follow her on Twitter at Pushing Hoops. Coming up on Latino USA.
We all have to work harder to do the job that we've been trying to do all along, which is to provide high quality, you know, culturally competent health care. You know, I think that's a positive challenge, not a negative challenge.
Stay with us. No se vayan.
Caras rotas que sueñan con rosas que
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. California has led the nation in the number of people getting insurance through the Affordable Care Act. But even so, there are still millions in the state without insurance. Reporter Lisa Moorhouse checks in on some of those places that serve as safety nets for these people, the community clinics and the public hospitals for Californians who have nowhere else to go.
Cathedral City in Southern California is sandwiched between the tourist towns of Palm Springs and Rancho Mirage, but it's not really like them. It's a mostly Latino community, home to a lot of hospitality workers who serve the resorts. In the corner of a shopping center here is where you'll find Centro Médico. Manager Daisy Morfin sees a lot of pent-up need for medical care here. Since enrollment in the Affordable Care Act started last fall, she says the clinic got up to 10 new patients a day. Many are people who now qualify for health care for the first time in years, or ever.
Now they're coming and we need to take care of multiple chronic issues. So we're having to deal with a lot of referrals, a lot of things that need to be taken care of, medication that hasn't been adjusted in months. It's a big difference.
Right now, the workload's bigger for everyone, but Morfin's not complaining. She knows that after these new patients get their needs met, the volume of appointments will drop, and she's happy to see them taken care of. So is Counselor Joanna Ramos.
It is very satisfying, especially for those that come in and they've been discouraged in the past.
The Affordable Care Act helps Californians get insurance in two main ways. One is through expanded Medicaid. The other, buying it through the state's insurance exchange, with subsidies if they're under a certain income. Still, not everyone here is covered. Ramos sees a lot of families in which different members have different options. Take the people who work in hospitality in the resort towns nearby.
And a lot of them do have health insurance through their employer.
So for the employee of that resort or hotel or restaurant, insurance is affordable, but other family members might not be covered.
Dad doesn't need insurance, but if we add mom, he's going to pay, you know, outrageous amounts of premiums.
And the clinic has a lot of undocumented patients, a group explicitly excluded from getting insurance under the Affordable Care Act.
We have a lot of households where everybody has legal status except for, like, mom. We've seen that a lot.
Ramos has counseled a number of patients who fall between the cracks. They earn too much for Medicaid, but even if they qualify for subsidies, they feel they can't afford insurance on the exchange.
I've had some that refuse to enroll, that they leave upset, you know, and of course, I mean, there's nothing much I can say is, I'm sorry, that's what you qualified for.
All of these people are the most at risk for not getting the care they need. The responsibility of caring for them falls to the counties, but counties have a lot of flexibility in determining how to do that. They can set their own standards for who receives free or low-cost care and how much to help undocumented people.
We've always taken all comers without regard to payer source.
That's Gary Gray, a family doctor and chief medical officer at Natividad Medical Center in Monterey County. From almost every window here, you can see row crops. A large number of Natividad's patients are farm workers.
I think it's fitting that we come to work and we kind of look out at fields every day. I think it kind of reminds us of who we are and our mission and responsibilities.
Monterey County is projected to have the highest percentage of uninsured people in the state as the Affordable Care Act rolls out. That's partly because of the large proportion of undocumented residents here. Historically, state and federal programs compensated safety net hospitals like Natividad. But now, as more patients get covered, that funding is being cut. That puts pressure on hospitals like this one to hold on to patients who now have insurance in order to subsidize those who don't.
I think we all have to work harder to do the job that we've been trying to do all along, which is to provide high quality, you know, culturally competent health care. With the changing in demographics of insured populations, I think we will all have to work a little harder. And, you know, I think that's a positive challenge, not a negative challenge.
Natividad may be up to the task because it's focused on welcoming the county's most needy patients for years. The cafeteria is filled with beautiful photographs of local produce many of their patients pick. Hallways are lined with Mexican-style murals featuring patients, doctors, and MRI machines. There's an extensive language interpretation program. And over the last several years, the hospital expanded its specialty services, Dr. Gray says, like pain management, dermatology, and spine surgery.
And some of those services were not previously available to our patients in Monterey County at all.
A lot of questions loom. What will happen to people explicitly left out of insurance programs? Will there still even be uninsured people in the future? What will the safety net look like in 10 years?
I don't think anyone knows. I think healthcare reform is a thoughtful experiment.
For Latino USA, I'm Lisa Morehouse.
A mí me gusta andar de pelo suelto, me gusta todo lo que sea misterio, me gusta ir siempre en contra del viento, si dicen blanco yo les digo negro.
When society tells you that you have to change in order to fit in, it's pretty normal to wonder, why? Why can't I stay the way I am? Latino USA producer Brenda Salinas has this story about how the natural hair movement is growing in the Afro-Latino community.
In the 1960s, natural black hair became a revolutionary political statement in the U.S. Wearing an afro was a physical expression of black pride and black beauty. It was polarizing, but exciting. Who could forget Pam Grier's sexy do?
Pam Grier, that one chick hit squad who creamed you as coffee, is back.
But relaxers, straighteners, and weaves are still a $9 billion industry in this country. In 2009, comedian Chris Rock directed a documentary called Good Hair.
Just yesterday, my daughter came into the house and said, "Daddy, how come I don't have good hair? I wonder how she came up with that idea."
In 2012, Olympic gymnast Gabby Douglas was criticized for her kinky ponytail. Here she is talking to Oprah.
I looked at my mentions and they were just like, "Don't talk about Gabby's hair like that. I love Gabby's hair." Or, "Gabby Doug, you're pretty just the way you are."
But in the Afro-Latino community, there really haven't been that many cultural icons sporting natural hair. That's where Carolina Contreras comes in.
I noticed there's a movement going on in the U.S., a natural hair movement. All these blogs in English, but nothing in Spanish.
She created the blog Miss Rizos to connect with other Afro-Latinas who wanted to give their natural hair a try.
Hola, chicas. ¿Cómo están? Aquí les tengo un pequeño videito sobre el moño que llevaba ayer.
At the age of 7, Carolina started getting her naturally curly hair relaxed every 2 months. She says her family just saw it as part of their personal hygiene.
You use this chemical that smells really, really bad. It smells like rotten eggs. Almost in mayonnaise. And, you know, you have to grease your scalp because it can burn your scalp. My mom would apply the relaxer in sections and she would have to wear plastic latex gloves and she would have to use a very thin tooth comb to make sure she combed out all of the kinks of the hair. And I remember crying every time I did it because she would leave it in for a long time and I would tell her just to please get it out and she would yell at me that if I wanted straight Chinese looking hair that I would have to wait until it processed. So then once she removed it with water, she would use vinegar to neutralize the hair. And imagine putting vinegar on almost an open wound because your scalp would be so sensitive from the chemicals in the relaxer. So the vinegar was so painful. And that's the process. And then after that, you know, Dominicans in their roller sets, so she would put me into some rollers and some bobby pins, and I would get under the dryer for about 2 hours because I have a lot of hair, 2.5 hours sometimes. And then once I got out of the dryer, I would blow dry my hair, and that's another hour. So I would spend about 6 hours. And I have 3 sisters, and I mean, I learned how to relax hair too, so I would do the same process to them because it was something so normal. I think about it now and it's like I inflicted so much pain on them. I feel like it's something that I'm still healing from.
Sure, her kinky hair required a lot of attention. But Carolina says what really led her to relax her hair was a feeling that her curls weren't presentable.
If you work for a bank in the DR, you're most likely going to get a weekly stipend to go to the salon. I can't even fully explain why. They just feel like it's not professional.
And that message, she says, trickles all the way down to little girls.
it's frustrating to have to deal with the way our hair looks when we go into work, or when we go in to serve our nation. Our hair has nothing to do with our productivity or with our intelligence or with our knowledge about a specific subject or anything. It has absolutely nothing to do.
Raquel Cepeda is a journalist and author. She says in the Afro-Latina community, natural hair is still a political statement.
As soon as they see the curly hair, they say, oh, she's a leftist, she's this, she's that, she's that. To me, it's a badge of honor. It's how I honor my ancestors, by letting them live freely in my scalp and in my hair and that expression, that free expression.
She says she feels free to wear her hair curly because she knows what it really means.
When you learn about your history, you tend to start being proud of where you come from. And then the curly hair won't be a thing.
And once everybody understands their heritage, hair can be just hair. Carolina Contreras of the Miss Rizos blog says she's inspired her family. Her mom and her sisters have stopped relaxing their hair, too. And every time she goes back to the DR, she feels more hopeful.
I just get really excited because I see a lot more women in the street wearing their natural hair. I start seeing more ads on TV, and you see it all over now.
Beauty can hurt, sure, but it can be freeing once you do it because you want to and not because you feel you have to. For Latino USA, I'm Brenda Salinas.
And now for the me's that are sometimes not me. Some linguists are saying that multilingual people can have different personalities depending on what language they're speaking. This idea recently resonated with two of our Latino USA producers, Brenda Salinas and Camilo Vargas.
So, Camilo, last week there was an article that we both really reacted to. You want to talk a little bit about the research?
Yeah, researchers are basically saying that we don't necessarily change personalities when we change languages. What we actually do is some aspects of our personalities become accentuated. Some languages bring out certain parts of ourselves that other languages do not.
So they're not saying that the languages themselves have a personality, but that depending on what sphere you speak that language in?
Yeah, but we're basically changing spheres and we're adapting to the environment where we're speaking. And of course, this hit home here because you have an experience going from Spanish to English, and I have a very different experience going from Spanish to English. I started learning English when I was 6 in elementary school. It's fair to say that first, English was a language of authority. In the recess time, we would all speak Spanish, and that would be like playtime, relax time. And then we'd go back into English mode where we would learn, you know, math and all these things. Now for you, it's different.
Yeah, my experience is really different. So when we moved to the U.S., the only thing I knew was a pollito chicken song. Do you know that song?
No.
Pollito chicken, gallina hen. That song.
Yeah.
That's all I knew. I mean, knowing farm animals and pencil and pen doesn't really get you anywhere. I didn't have that gradual transition. I was just immersed into English. And I'm pretty light-skinned, and I wasn't around a lot of other Latinos. So it took me about a year to be fluent. I think I probably had an accent for a few years. But to me, English was always what we spoke at school, and it was always a way for me to pass, whether I wanted to or not. It was like Spanish was always my family's secret. So for me, I really feel like my English and Spanish personalities are really different. I played a lot of sports growing up, and we would play volleyball. You know, you always have to shout for the ball. You always have to call it. And I could never do that in English because it felt like when something was coming at my face, translating it was an extra step. But if you had asked me, I would have said that I thought in English because I can think in English, and half the day I spent it thinking in English. But when something's coming at my face, I say mía. I don't say mine.
Right.
Because people always ask me, well, first of all, they ask me when the U.S. and Mexico play in soccer, who do you root for? And I say Mexico, obviously. But they always ask me, do you think in English or do you think in Spanish? And I say, well, you know, I think in both, but I feel in Spanish.
What does that mean?
For example, I can't get mad in English. When I try to get mad in English, there's something that gets stuck in my throat and the words don't come out. But in Spanish, I don't know if it's something about Spanish, but it's so easy to get mad at someone in Spanish. You're like, eres un descarado. You can't say that in English. I feel like Spanish is a much more emotional language. But at the same time, I understand that someone who grew up speaking another language at home and spoke Spanish at school would probably feel that Spanish was a colder language, and that's the way I feel about English.
Well, my experience with learning English and then mastering English and then the possibilities that English actually opens up for someone is very different. And it's different to an intimate level. By the time I was a teenager, I started to realize that, you know, I was gay. And I only came out very late in my teenage years. It was something that I never really talked about with anyone except maybe my sister. I also spoke English at home because my sister was also bilingual because she had been living in the U.S. So English became a sort of secret language between my sister and me. My parents, they're not fully fluent in English, nor are my grandparents. So my sister and I, every time we were planning something or doing something secret, we would speak in English. It was our play language. And that started to take another dimension as I started to realize that I was gay. Because not only did I talk to my sister about it in English, and the words that I used didn't hit me so close to home, because, saying, gay in Espanol was really, emotional for me. It was like, oh my God, I'm really coming out of the closet. But if I said it in English, it was still playful. It was still this sort of, fantasy world.
A role you were playing.
Exactly. Exactly. A performance. All these shows started coming out in American television, Will and Grace and maybe even The Nanny and a bunch of
Queer Eye for the Straight Guy.
Queer Eye for the Straight
Great
Guy
show.
And Queer as Folk. And all these sort of cultural references were coming to Colombia in English. And you had all these awesome characters that were incredibly sassy, super witty. And that is how I started to build the sort of quote unquote gay personality. Like the sassy gay guy that you see on those comedies. That's the role I started to play.
So would you say you're more gay in English?
Definitely. Definitely. I listen to myself on tape and it sounds like I'm less controlled in that sense. At some point, English was the language of freedom.
It's interesting because I feel much more repressed in English. And I think it has a lot to do with my skin color. I feel like when I'm speaking in English, I have this big immigrant eye stamped on my forehead. When I'm with my American friends, especially with my boyfriend's family, they're the nicest people, but they'll say things sometimes that I just can't relate to. Even something simple when he was growing up, he got to pick what food he was going to eat. And I never got to pick what food I was going to eat.
You just ate whatever was on the table.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I just feel like those kind of experiences, you see my skin color and maybe they assume that I can relate to these things, but really my secret is that I'm putting on this act. My English is me passing, is me performing, me saying, oh, everything is okay. And it's only in Spanish where I feel like I'm myself, really. In my relationship, sometimes I get very concerned because my boyfriend doesn't speak Spanish at all. We speak exclusively in English. And sometimes I wonder, he's falling in love with my English personality. Is he falling in love with the true me?
That's a really good question.
Yeah, there are a lot of questions, and we want to hear what you, our listeners, think. Do bilingual people have multiple personalities? We're going to have a Facebook thread going on about this, and you can tweet at LatinoUSA. I'm Brenda Salinas.
And I'm Camilo Vargas.
And we'll be having this conversation with you online.
Esta es nuestra fiesta, candado y crestas, nuestra fiesta.
¡Nuestra!
Este es nuestro vals, radio.
Coming up on Latino USA. As Brazil gets ready to host the World Cup, protesters take to the malls. Stay with us. No se vayan. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. The political unrest in Venezuela is never far from the minds and the hearts of Venezuelans living in the United States. It takes a toll on their families, like sisters Ana and Maria Gonzalez, which are not their real names. About 14 years ago, Ana moved to Atlanta, Georgia to attend school. Maria still lives in Caracas, where she works as a dentist. They told their story to Martha Dalton of WABE in Atlanta.
We actually had a really good childhood, a very good upbringing.
Siempre fuimos muy unidas porque éramos solamente nosotras.
We were always very close because it was only the two of us, the two sisters. We always tried to do everything together. And even now that we're adults, despite the fact that we're separated in two different places, we still make a lot of plans together.
I do worry about something happening to her in the course of her daily life.
Yo siento particularmente que ha cambiado muchísimo. Y pues lamentablemente tengo que decir que ha cambiado para peor.
I feel that the country has changed tremendously, and unfortunately, it has changed for the worse. They've made us live a life where we're always worried about everything, from what we can buy at the grocery store, to our own personal safety, to whether our rights to express what we think and what we want are going to be respected.
I worry about her just being out and going to her job every day.
Siempre que estoy en el carro,
anytime I'm in the car, I'm always afraid someone is going to come near me and rob me.
Pienso que me va a robar.
The government is still engaging in all kinds of human and civil rights violations with the opposition leaders and with all the protesters that have been imprisoned.
Y estando en el consultorio,
when I'm at my dentistry office, I'm always fearful that somebody's going to break in and rob me.
I know that there's still students who are out in the streets protesting, but the general mood down there is that nobody can go against the regime and nobody can counter what the regime is doing, and that it's pointless to continue to fight. So that people just have to learn to live with the way things work or don't work down there. And so that makes me feel just hopeless. You know, there's no hope for a change.
La gente se ha cansado un poco, pero sin embargo, los estudiantes.
Some people have grown tired, but there are some, especially students, who continue to fight.
Creo que más de tres meses ya, algunos de ellos.
My closest friends down there and my sister and my cousins, they are all trying to find a way to leave the country.
Desde hace años, probablemente.
We've been thinking about it for years now. It's probably been about 9 years that we've been thinking of leaving the country.
That makes me really sad because I was the first person to leave, but I left because of different reasons, and it didn't have to do with the political and economic situation and safety. But they are leaving because of that. And it's almost like my roots, my cultural roots and my cultural heritage. It's just being lost because Venezuela is becoming, it's a diaspora. And that's what's happening to my family and to my friends. And that really makes me sad.
I see things getting more difficult every day. Every day I'm more worried.
I'm actually scheduled to be there at the end of this month.
Ella es una chica muy, se sabe cuidar muy bien.
She's a girl who knows how to take good care of herself. But every time she comes here, I try to take care of her too.
Cuidarla, llevarla.
When I go to Venezuela, I always tell people here, you know that it's likely that I won't come back or that I won't come back in one piece. So I already know that, but I've also learned to just accept it and live with it and make the best of the time that I spend every time I go back to Venezuela.
Martha Dalton of WABE produced our story for us. Across Brazil, many of the poor and working class there are feeling pushed aside as the country gets ready to host this year's World Cup. Protest movements are gaining momentum. One of them is called a rolezinho, or a little stroll. Rolezinhos are mass gatherings organized on social media, where youth from working-class suburbs come to hang out at the mall and take a little stroll. But as Milena Spitzer reports, these innocent meetups have now become flashpoints in the protests against racism and class prejudice.
Oh!
Outside the shiny glass facade of one of Rio de Janeiro's most upscale shopping malls, teenagers pound the concrete, dancing and jumping. There will be no World Cup, they shout. They're angry that the government has spent so much money preparing for the World Cup, while poor people haven't benefited. People go to the Rolezinhos to have fun, to eat, and to flirt, explains Iata Anderson. He's a student from the Rocinha favela, one of Rio's largest working-class neighborhoods. Malls are especially attractive for teens in cities with few public spaces. That is, until the police crack down. In Sao Paulo, kids got pepper sprayed in the face and tear gassed, Iata says. This mall in Rio is trying to preempt any unrest by not opening its doors. That's Susan, a saleswoman at a fancy clothing store. I'm talking to her in the dressing room because mall security is tailing me. She's against the Rolezinhos. She says there are better ways to protest. It makes it difficult for the workers whose livelihoods depend on sales, she says. We don't know if the mall will open or if it will be dangerous to go to work. Outside the barricaded mall, Aaron Moraes de Melo is dressed in a head-to-toe Batman costume. He has become an icon of Brazil's protest movement. The government, the media, the state are trying to say there's no more racial prejudice, Batman explains. But that's a lie, he says. It's part of the culture. Here's a case in point. Recently, a group of white middle-class vigilantes attacked a homeless black teenager for allegedly mugging people. They left him naked and chained to a pole in a public park with a bicycle lock around his neck. But some Brazilians defend the vigilantes.
A atitude dos vingadores é até compreensível.
That's TV news host Raquel Scheherazade.
É o que eu chamo de
She says the Avengers are justified because law enforcement isn't reigning in the violence.
De violência sem limite.
That's exactly the kind of attitude that bothers a young man we'll call Pedro. He says it's absurd.
É absurdo.
Pedro is a skinny 19-year-old with a big smile who lives in a favela uphill from the mall. All the residents of the favela come down the hill to go grocery shopping, he says. There's prejudice. Security will follow you. And people from the asphalt, that is, wealthier people, don't go up into the favela. Why? They say most of the people who live there are traffickers. But that's just not true, says Pedro.
No, a maioria que mora aqui é trabalhador.
Most favela residents are workers and students, he says. In fact, to make that point, he's inviting people to a rolezinho up here in his neighborhood. The idea, he says, is to bring people from the asphalt up to the favela to see what life is really like. As we head off to another rolezinho, we come to a checkpoint at the bottom of the hill. The lighter-skinned members of our group are allowed to pass, but one young man, who is black, is stopped and searched by the military police. I ask the officers why they chose to search him. He's not discriminating, he tells me. He's just doing his job. Protests are expected to escalate in the lead-up to the World Cup, and the government is responding in kind. It's considering stronger anti-terrorism laws that could jail protesters for up to 30 years for inciting violence. For Latino USA, I'm Milena Spitzer in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil.
That's the sound of lucha libre, or wrestling, which is a national pastime in Mexico. Buff fighters jump into the ring donning superhero costumes. Most of them are masked. They exchange threats and insults. They flip up in the air. They smack each other down. They pin each other up. It is a macho sport. But what some people don't realize is that its stars are just as likely to be women as men. Jasmine Gartz reports.
It's a cool Sunday afternoon in Mexico City. Somewhere in the maze of streets that's the neighborhood of San Miguel de Otongo, a lucha libre is taking place. The crowd goes wild as a petite woman with delicate features and the compact body of a gymnast comes out. Her name is Lady Apache.
Por el lado técnico, Lady Apache. Janet Junior.
It wasn't always like this. When Lady Apache was a kid, she was just Sandra Gonzalez, and she used to get bullied a lot. Then one day, she decided to make it stop. She trains in a rough part of Mexico City, in a rundown building that looms over a sea of street vendors.
Me agarraban de bajada, como decimos nosotros, ¿no? O sea, las niñas, el dichoso bullying y este...
González is listing the tortures she endured in school. There was a lot of hair pulling, a lot of shoving, and let's just say her lunch money didn't last too long in her pocket. She told her dad that she wanted to take a personal defense class.
A los 14 años me invitan a formar parte de una función y es la primera vez que yo veo... lucha de mujeres.
When she was 14, she got invited to showcase her new self-defense skills at an event that also featured female fighters. And that's when she fell in love with Mexican wrestling. Bruce Wayne became Batman, Clark Kent changed into Superman, and Sandra Gonzalez became Lady Apache. Yes. Yes. The training gym has several rings. The fighters jump over each other, charge at one another, and practice how to fall when they get slammed down. The trainer is Fuerza Guerrera, or Warrior Force. Young Sandra Gonzalez was one of the first women he ever trained.
Mira, la verdad es yo soy uno de los más reacios a luchar con mujer,
During a break from practicing, he tells me that honestly, he wasn't too happy about teaching a girl to fight.
Desafortunadamente, digo, en México vivimos todavía en gran parte el machismo en México.
Lady Apache says, unfortunately, Mexico is still a very sexist country. The first luchadoras back in the 50s and 60s had it pretty bad from some of their colleagues. The men used to sabotage them with pranks, like gluing their wrestling boots to the floor or knotting their leggings so tight they couldn't be undone. But eventually, they gained acceptance.
Ver las ganas que ellas le ponían y lo que ellas desarrollaban arriba del ring.
Even Fuerza Guerrera says he overcame his skepticism once women proved to him that they could get in the ring and fight as well as anyone else.
Y siento yo que ahorita, bueno, pues la gran mayoría de los compañeros son mucho más accesibles que anteriormente, ¿no?
Lady Apache has spent more than 20 years in lucha libre. She says she can feel the difference. Fellow fighters are much more supportive these days.
Arriba del ring, todos somos luchadores y bueno, todos estamos preparados para eso, ¿no?
And in the ring, she concludes, we're all just fighters. Back in San Miguel de Otongo, Lady Apache jumps into action. The fighters strut, open-armed, like exasperated roosters. The only thing more mesmerizing than her skills is the reaction of the audience. The men clearly want her, and the women want to be her. And to the children, she's a real live action hero. The fight ends, and Lady Apache wins. As she heads back to the dressing rooms, she's mobbed by groupies asking for pictures and autographs. The girl who used to get her lunch money stolen has come a long way. For Latino USA, I'm Jasmine Garst in Mexico City.
Date cuenta.
We took a kind of straw poll at our office a few weeks ago. We wanted to come up with the whitest thing we could think of. Okay, any guesses? Well, it was NASCAR. Of the roughly 76 full-time NASCAR drivers, all but two are American-born. One of the non-American drivers is Mexico City's Germán Quiroga, who started his career by winning three consecutive NASCAR Corona Series, the most important stock car series in Mexico. 2 years ago, he came to the United States to try his hand at the American Series. For this week's Sabiduría, or Words of Wisdom, NASCAR's only full-time Latin American driver, talks about his racing journey. Here's Germán Quiroga.
Racing an oval, everybody will say, oh, it's easier because you just turn left and it's pretty simple. Once you start racing in ovals, you find that it's not that easy, it's not that simple, and it's more complicated. I started racing when I was 14 years old. My passion always has been, since I've been born, race cars, motorcycles.
Oh, look here, Armand's going back around Coulter. We saw Coulter.
I mean, I always felt like I was a race car driver. I always imagined myself as a race car driver. The first time I got the experience to be in a real racetrack and be competitive, that's where I thought, okay, this is for me.
Very strong truck tonight for Armand. You don't win 3 Mexico championships if you're not a great racer, and Armand's proven that he's a great racer.
After being a 3-time champion, I decided to move to the United States without a sponsorship and trying to find one, find a team, and start working, trying to be competitive and learn as much as I can.
Wireless number 77 has been strong since the drop of the green flag, still running up in the top 5.
As the only Mexican and Hispanic driver in NASCAR, in the national divisions of NASCAR, of course I want to do well. I think it's growing, the fan base here in the United States for sure. The Hispanics, I think they're going to turn around whenever I start doing very well in the series.
Outstanding run by Germán Quiroga tonight.
It's time. It's not going to happen from one day to the next one, and I completely understand. But for sure, the more I can do for the fans and the better I can represent my flag in the racetrack, the better it's going to be for us.
Germán Quiroga races number 77 in the NASCAR Camping World Truck Series. He spoke to us from Charlotte, North Carolina. And mis queridos, that's it for today. We hope you're feeling a little bit more included and that you join us again next time. Latino USA is produced by AC Valdez, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Brenda Salinas, and Camilo Vargas. Our engineer is Cornelius McMuller. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen, and special thanks to the folks at KQED and especially Rob Spate. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week, and in the meantime, find us on Facebook, Twitter, and on Tumblr. And I'll see you on my Instagram, Maria_la_Hinojosa. Hasta la próxima.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all. And the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. And the California Endowment, building a strong state by improving the health of all Californians. Latino USA's tech coverage is supported by the Kaper Center for Social Impact, which leverages technology for positive, progressive change. Tech for good, good for tech. KaperCenter.org.
I buy the white eggs because I'm racist, okay?
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Lumber Liquidators, hardwood, bamboo, and cork flooring with a Floor Finder app for iPad and iPhone. Learn more at lumberliquidators.com. And the Lemelson Foundation, supporting inventors and invention to improve lives in the U.S. and developing countries, on the web at lemelson.org. And the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.